Before we begin the episode, I'd like to thank our sponsor, RTP Physiotherapy, founded by chartered physiotherapists Tony Fox and Thomas Dively. Based in St. Jude's GA Club, Templeogue, RTP specialise in physiotherapy, return to play, physical health and performance. For more information, you can visit their website, rtp.physio, or their Instagram page, @physio_RTP for more. Welcome back to the Sideline Live podcast. You can follow us over on Twitter and Instagram at The Sideline Live. We'd love to hear from you. On episode 103, I'm delighted to be joined by performance nutritionist, best-selling author, and founder of Davy Nutrition, Daniel Davy. On this episode, we discuss all things performance, his time at Leinster and the Dublin Senior Footballers, the impact of relationships, sustaining success, Jim Gavin, and so much more. Hi, Daniel. Thanks a million for joining me on the podcast.
My pleasure. It's great to be here this morning.
You're obviously in Sligo at the moment. So for you growing up, sport was obviously a big influence in your life, really.
It was. Sport, farming, and food. That was, you know, my youth was about... It was about the potential of playing first for your club and then looking on and seeing the senior players and doing what they could do and being a part of that and being a part of the community. And then hopefully one day going on and potentially representing your county. So, yeah, I mean, your environment and your home has a big influence on you. And my home and particularly my dad had a big influence because he had played football, even to inter-county level with Sligo in goals. So just a big part of a conversation throughout my youth.
Mm-hmm. For you, going through those age groups at inter-county level and kind of realising you had talent and making it to the senior panel, what was that experience like for you, kind of being first introduced into kind of a high performance, that word is thrown around a lot, environment? How did you find the whole experience?
Well, we're talking about a good few years ago. So I'm going to be very honest and say that I played with an intermediate team here in Sligo, and the intermediate football was never really taken particularly seriously, and it didn't really matter how well I performed or what I did. The breaking into an inter-county team at all age grades was always that bit more challenging if you weren't from one of the senior clubs and you didn't have the exposure of a St. Mary's or a Tour de Strand. So while I was fortunate to make development squads and I made all of the teams from, you know, under 16 up to under 21, breaking into the senior county team was a big challenge for me. And it was something that I never gave up on, and it was something that I always wanted to do, but it certainly wasn't like I went from under 21 into senior. That's not how it went. I had to go and play football in England with London and then come back and play. But what I can say about it was always the space that I wanted to get into. And it was the collective energy and just the collective effort that drove me on. That's what I wanted to be a part of.
Okay, interesting. I actually didn't know you played for London as well. What was it about the team? Is it kind of, we were speaking before we hit record about kind of the community you get with a team and kind of the openness of that college team you observed. What was it about a team that made you tick? Was it the being part of a group? Could you just pinpoint something that you love being part of a team? Because I get the sense I'd be the same. I'd struggle as an individual athlete. I need my teammates. I need people to be around.
Well, I didn't necessarily always feel like that. And I doubted whether I was suited to a team myself when I've moved away from the word obsession. There's potentially negative connotations and outcomes from obsession the same way as there's potentially positive things. But when I was young, I ran the roads. You know, I started thinking about food from a very young age. I wouldn't contemplate missing training, and not everybody shared that. So I often wondered, was I better off looking at a different sport where I was just accountable to myself? But as things went on, and as time went on, I felt the support of others when things weren't going well. And you know, you soon realize that you really, no matter how hard you train, and no matter how well you're playing, you're always going to have periods where you're going to have dips, or you're going to have your challenges, and you need those people around you to keep moving forward. And that was something that I realized the value in. And I think the other thing was, as time went on, I'm struggling to find the right words or right way of putting it, but I got a lot of satisfaction out of encouraging others. You know, that was something that did give me a sense of pride to try and bring the best out in those around me.
At the start of your professional career, I know you got involved kind of with the Dublin Herders in an early stage, which led to opportunities with footballers and then eventually Leinster. Talk us through the start of that career.
I was working with a supplement company called ROS Nutrition back then, and I was part of that startup. And I actually didn't necessarily want to get into that space, but jobs were incredibly limited in performance nutrition back then. But a job came up with the Dublin Hurling team around 2010, 2011, and the strength and conditioning coach at the time was Martin Kennedy, who was a good friend of mine, and he gave me the opportunity to present the strategies and programs, and it was amazing. Like, I used to go to training, they were in the gym at 6 o'clock. I tried to get to trainings beforehand, or I go in the evenings, and There was an unbelievable drive at that time, and there was a really good group. And Anthony Daly was managing the team, and you know, he had a lot of experience, and he knew what it took to be successful. And I just loved every single aspect of it. I loved the curiosity and the interest, and it was the first real time that I saw my input having a measurable difference. And I just knew that was the path I wanted to go.
Brilliant. I was actually in NADA, Martin's company, and I remember being in St. David's and seeing all of the equipment. It would have been about 2014, 2015, and seeing all the Dublin footballers and the leaderboard and all the different stats. I definitely think there was like a mental thing at that you'd be able to look at. I think it's actually interesting. Stephen Cluxton was up at the top of a lot of those categories. I think there was nearly a mental thing where you go into the environment and you see who's the leaderboard and you're going to chase the pack and chase the leader. But it's interesting that you see all that coming straight in with the Dublin Hurlers, even in 2010. Like, everyone says, you know, Intercounty's gone so professional, but it probably started back at the late 08, 09, 10, do you think?
Definitely. You know, there's no doubt at that point that there were the structures being put in place for high performance and for people to excel. What I suppose what has changed is that there's been a big development in the broader picture. You know, while things like the different pillars, whether it be sleep, psychology, nutrition, the management of volume of training and the intensity that these athletes are working at, there's just a greater depth of understanding of what that looks like. And I think that the other thing that's fascinating is that the cultures have evolved so much that there's just more buy-in to the whole to the whole thing. You know, there's a real recognition now that you're not going to be at your best if you're not committed to this.
Yeah, exactly. And you discussed that before, and I wasn't going to get into the kind of the real details of nutrition, but something you mentioned before was, you know, a lot of it's actually based in habits and the kind of psychology. Are you open to change, and are you willing to change your daily habits? Because even like I've heard intercounty players speak before at camps and different things, they're like, you know, how do you kind of eat healthy? And it's like, it's actually just a habit, you know, the 80-20 rule. They know when they go to the petrol station, they don't pick up the packet of crisps, they pick up the fruit snack or the protein bar or something. But that's actually ultimately what you think nutrition is down to. It's just those habits and those psychological factors.
Yeah, so when I would begin the conversation with anybody around nutrition. You talk about the skills. So what are their skills? What are their practical abilities? That comes down to how they plan, how they manage their time, their cooking skills, their understanding of how food is put together. And then there's the knowledge aspect. Do you have the knowledge to put those meals together? Do you know when to eat? Do you know the timings? Do you know what food fits at the right place? And then there's the person's own drive, interest, desire, and that's the mental skills associated with it. So really understanding how to create a strategy around all of that. And at the very core of that is how you behave and the habits that you form. So if you're not focused on building out those habits, and if you don't have them in a way that is incremental and sustainable, then, you know, no matter how good your skills are, no matter where your knowledge is, then you're not going to maintain a level of consistency that's needed to be successful.
Okay, interesting. There's a great quote you had, I think it was on the Movement 101 podcast, and you said every single person who works as part of a backroom team, whether it's Dublin or Leinster, is held accountable for success and failure. What's that like in an environment? Let's say, for example, if I was to go in as a player saying I'm not used to it, is it an adjustment period? Do you help players adjust to that? Is it? How did you find that environment? Because I suppose there's a lot of responsibility there put on every individual there, not only the players on the pitch.
Are you talking about when I started, or are you talking about a minor, broader picture?
Maybe even the evolution of, did you see it kind of coming in more? Is it now, was it always like that even when you started? Was it more towards the latter end of your career with Leinster and Dublin?
What has happened over the last 12 years is that the margins have just become so much tighter, and the expectations have become so much higher about what's needed. So I didn't really feel that pressure when I would have started. I would have been very excited about the opportunity, and I would have been very much all in on, you know, it. There was weeks where I would have done 60, 70, 80 hours. And when I wasn't working, I was thinking about how I could improve my job. So it completely consumed me. But then what begins to happen is that you set a standard, you have expectations of yourself, then the players have expectations, the management have expectations. And it's very hard to sustain all of that. And it's hard to evolve it. So what I'm much more conscious of now is making sure within any environment or any team that I'm associated with, just making sure that people have the essential aspects of nutrition covered, and that they have the tools to perform. And you can then allow you can evolve things more sustainably over time and introduce different things. But I would have gone crash, wallop, bang, and made some big mistakes when I went from, let's say, even Dublin to Leinster, because there was a very streamlined process that I wasn't used to. And it was like, I was thinking about it from a nutrition strategy perspective, that doesn't really make that much difference. But they had established structures. And I didn't, in the early stages, I didn't realize how important it was that the structure was over the importance of the strategy. So like, they would have hydration testing in Leinster at very specific times. And that was just the way things were done. So if I missed that, I wouldn't think it'd be a bigger deal. I could just do it at a time that I felt was more relevant, but that's not how they did it. So it's managing that as well as the actual practice. It's merging the two together.
Okay, interesting. Do you think that's the biggest or maybe it's just the evolution of Leinster, but is that sort of the biggest difference between, you see, the professional setup versus an intercounty team, that they can have these kind of Monday to Friday blocks of, let's say, specific hydration testing in the morning or in the afternoon, where you don't have access to an intercounty player for not only hydration testing but for anything?
That's one element of it for sure. I think there's just, when you're in an office environment and you're in there, whether it be 3 or 5 days a week, there's expectations that are just created over time, because there's just an intensity about every aspect of what people do, because that's their job, that you can't really explain. So the smallest example I can give you is, you know, let's say the food is late by 15 minutes. Honestly, it's like, I need to be careful here, but, you know, every single thing is, may, I'm not saying it is, but may need to be pushed back after that, because there's a schedule in place. There's a meeting at 1:45. There's a backs meeting at 2 o'clock. There's a management meeting at 2:30. You know, there's another, and so it creates that bit of chaos. And that was all because the food was late. You know, so it feels like there's an awful lot more pressure on something like that. Whereas if that happened in Dublin training, the lads would be like, "Oh, sure, I'll just eat it at home. I'll bring it with me." Like, it's just completely different.
What do you think, let's say, a professional setup could learn from an intercounty setup then? Like, obviously, like, intercounty, I know managers have gone into pro setups. I know Declan Darcy's involved with Leinster. But what can the professional side of things take from the intercounty scene?
Well, I talked about this every single week in my job in Leinster. And I had these conversations with management and colleagues, and, like, Leo and Stuart were in Leinster very, very open to learning from my experience of working with Dublin. And they would have asked me every single week how are things are going and what's been done and what can we learn. So it's not there's certainly no what's the word I'm looking for? I the words aren't coming to me, but they're not positioning themselves like they have all the answers. There is that interest in learning. I think if I was to pick something very specific, I think there's a really good culture in GAA and certain aspects of what they do from a broader connection to the culture and to the community. And you know, what's gone before, we feel in GAA, we feel very connected to. And I think in the professional game, people can move through there very quickly. They can have careers for 2 or 3 years and then they're out, they're gone. Whereas, like, I played for my home club and I played for Ballyboden for 8-9 years. And I feel at home in both of them. You know, you don't feel like you're on the outside now. And I suppose there's little elements like that. You know, I even see Leinster have done the 12 county tour this year, trying to connect more to the history, and that the players understand more about all of the counties that are in Leinster. And so there's lots of different elements like that I find interesting. But it's not one particular thing. There's definitely lots of elements about, you know, even simple things like the holidays, like the team holidays, and what those experiences were like with Dublin, and how that brings groups together is very powerful.
How close is the intercounty setup to professional And do you think we're kind of reaching this breaking point that, yes, we're striving to be the best athletes and footballers we can be, but if I'm also striving to have this professional career and they're pushing me to the top, we're kind of, are we going to hit a great breaking point at one point, do you think?
I don't know if we're going to hit a breaking point. You know, if we haven't hit one now, I don't know if there's a breaking point coming. I think it's the GAA at intercounty level, it is elite sport. It is, you know, the only thing that it's not called is, you know, what it's not is professional, just because the players are not being paid. But it is the investment of time and the attention that's going in at senior county level is every bit as much as professional sport. And if I was to look at, like, I'm involved with Ballyboden, still just helping out more in a supporting type of role. And like, what they're doing is what most inter-county teams are doing. There's only maybe more resources available, and but it's practically inter-county at club level too in Dublin.
Wow. Okay, because I was going to ask you about Ballyboden and your role in there, but it seems to be, obviously, Ballyboden a sincere, like a serious club, and obviously great pedigree. But to see, I was going to ask you, what's it like kind of maybe to take maybe a mini step back, but it seems like you haven't actually taken a huge step back from elite sport because Ballyboden is at such an elite level.
Well, one of the, so I'm not working with Dublin or Leinster anymore, and I've moved on to do my own thing. But something that I recognized very, very quickly, I mean, within the space of 2 or 3 weeks, is that I couldn't go. I just can't be without the conversations with the athletes around their performance. It's too important to me. So I Kenny Nocton is the Ballyboden manager. And I have a very good relationship with him, and a lot of the played with all of the backroom team, and I played with a lot of the players too. And I you know, there's a very, very good energy in the group, and this really good attitude, and there's a great openness to feedback. So no, I transferred home after the All-Ireland, so in 2016, and I played at home for a couple of years, and that was great too because I reconnected with a lot of people back home, and that, you know, that was just great, and got to play and my dad see me play again and all that kind of thing. So that was really positive. But no, I've moved back in. Just, it's not a very formal role, but I am connected to the group, and that feels really good.
You mentioned there, speaking about athletes, of all the players you could even pull on your playing career here, you've played with, against, or observed, or just had an opportunity to talk to, what are the common traits or patterns that you see between the elite players that are just that 1% ahead of the rest?
It's a very consistent pattern, and it is that somebody said to me once, that there's a different look in their eye. And I think that's so interesting, because when that person said, it was actually a woman that I met and was talking to sport, and she's not directly involved in sport, but she's really interested in sport. And we had this conversation around elite athletes. She said, there's a different look in their eye. And what I would describe it as is an ongoing interest and curiosity that, they're just not closed off to new ideas. And like, that was the biggest thing from my experience in Dublin, that I did some of the, you know, I had the freedom to do some of the things that would be considered absolutely off the wall. But there was an openness where they were like, oh, we'll give it a chance. You know, we'll have a think about it, and we'll try it without just saying this doesn't work. And then if like they didn't work, I said, oh geez, Daniel, that was an absolute waste of time. But I had the opportunity, and I felt that I could try these things. So what of course you need ability, and of course you need resilience, and of course you need to have the physical attributes to play the game. But if I was to narrow it down, it's that curiosity and also that just that ability to bounce back from injury, or when they make that mistake, just how quickly athletes reset. That tends to be a big part of who they are.
Okay, very interesting. Have you picked up anything from the athletes, different methods that they use, different concepts they have for themselves?
Every day, every single day I was in there, and being around these athletes, you just see, it's just astounding to watch belief on front of your eyes, like total belief. And it was only when I started playing football in Dublin myself, and I was surrounded by people who, you know, there's this attitude, we're just not going to be defeated. And it's that willingness to openly say that we are the best, and that we are going to do whatever it takes, and that there's a total commitment of actions to that language. And like you can get incredible buy-in from people who have that attitude once you're leading by actions too. So I suppose the big thing for me when I look at those athletes, it was that the work was always done, and then if there was something else that needed to be done, they'd do that too. And it was whatever it was, whether it be cold water immersion, whether it be the clothes that they wore, the undergarments. You know, if I said it was two bananas versus three bananas, if I said it was blueberries instead of cherries, you know, they trusted the process and did what was necessary.
And is that, when you say trust the process, is that something that's kind of reflected down, like even you said there, you know, you're leading by actions, but is that something, how did management set up, put that in and give that structure to players to have that buy-in? Or was it just ultimately the character of the individuals involved?
I know there's no question that that was created, and that the whole idea of achieving success and sustaining success was that if we are not buying into this collectively, this can't be sustained. You know, sustained success requires very clear standards in place for that to be achieved. And it's led from the top, and then it comes from the bottom up, you know. But all of those things, they have to be real. They can't be for show. You know, it's all this, there's so many references to, you know, what's done in the dark or what's done when people aren't watching. Like that comes to the surface. Like that really does come out if people buy into that or not. And people who don't, just don't stay the course.
Good point. How do you measure success when you're working with an athlete or with a team? Obviously, the team goals, they'll have their own goals. But for you, going into that setup as a performance nutritionist, what are your measurables? How do you measure success with a client?
It's incredibly complicated, and it's evolved a huge amount. And the easy way to say that my relationship or my support is measured, the really easy way, and the, you know, if you just want to look at it from a quantitative perspective, and you want metrics, it's distance covered, it's body fat, it's muscle mass. It's the weights that are lifted in the gym, it's energy levels. But for me, as I moved on, and I moved on from Leinster and moved on from Dublin, it's the quality of the relationship, it's the language that they use around food and that they use around mindset. It's an openness, it's a willingness to try things, it's lifelong skills that they're going to use themselves to keep themselves healthy and keep themselves energized. And it's the influence that they're going to have on their family. But that does really, it comes down to the quality of the relationship. And that's something I value hugely and measure. You know, if I think about the success, it's like, how would I feel if the athletes that I worked with were in fantastic shape, performing really well, avoiding injury and illness, being successful on the field of play, but yet I couldn't have a conversation with them outside of it. I'd never a relationship with them. I think that would, I would find that very difficult, and I'd find it really hard to feel like that was a successful period of time or relationship.
I love the way you referenced, because I've been working with different coaches and as a coach, and it's like you might not be the most qualified or have the most knowledge, but it's actually sometimes down to the relationship you have with the athlete or with the coach.
There's absolutely no question about it. And just as you mentioned Martin Kennedy, like one of the reasons my personal relationship with Martin has always been very strong. But, you know, when Martin moved on from Dublin, Martin was gone 2 years, and we would be sitting around after games and somebody would mention Martin Kennedy, and somebody would say what a man Martin Kennedy was. And they'd say something like, you know, I don't know how he knew that there was something that just wasn't right, or I wasn't myself, but I'd get a message from Martin going, you know, how are you doing? How are you feeling? And like, that said an awful lot to me. You know, I thought to myself, you know, can you imagine if I was gone from Dublin, you know, I'm gone a year. I'm sorry, this last year was misty. Like if I was gone and somebody said, do you remember Daniel told us this? Like, that's what I wanted. That's it. And I knew that it was not going to be how many grams of protein or how many carbs that they consumed that was going to have that impact.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Out of interest then, kind of Jim Gavin, I think, is an interesting character. I'm trying to get him on the podcast, proven difficult. But what did you learn from him? How did you find him as a leader and to work with, and his approach with the players?
Yeah. I mean, Jim was a visionary. And Jim was an extraordinary leader, and he, you know, it's as time goes on, and the further that you're out of the environment, or the longer I'm out of the environment, you realize just the impact and the legacy that he's left. And the reason why he was so successful was because he was so clear on the values that he wanted to establish, what team first meant, what it meant to get complete buy-in and have trust within the group of the all of the processes that were being implemented. But even while there was that level of standard, that level of challenge, there was huge autonomy. And you were once you knew, or he knew, that you were meeting the standards of the group, you were given free rein to shape the program as you felt would best meet the needs of the players and the group. And that was amazing. Like that was so fulfilling, because you really felt like you were having a tangible impact. But the other thing was that Jim always asked really good questions, and he always supported my messages. So, you know, whether that be on the bus after the game, or, you know, Daniel, is there anything you want to say before training? Like that is empowerment. You know, that is sending such a strong message to the group that he believed in my message. And I will always be very grateful for that.
When you mentioned questioning, is that again down to that curiosity that we mentioned earlier, that kind of, you know, always open to new ideas, always looking for that extra edge?
Like nobody I could explain. He believed in that constant drive, that there was always something that would help to keep the group ahead of the competition. But I even mean, he would challenge me around, like, let's say, for example, I remember one day. I remember one day he wanted me to push something around the energy levels because, and the level of energy that the players were using, that the level of carbohydrate or energy the players were consuming, because the training sessions were going to be really tough. And I talked about the amount of specific carbohydrate that was required, and he brought me out onto the field and he said, "Can you talk me through that again?" And I talked him through it again in front of the group. And he said, "Well, why isn't that here?" And I said, you know, it wasn't that it wasn't there. It was that it wasn't there in the specific form that he wanted it in. You know, he wanted a gel, a drink, an electrolyte drink, and that all options should be there if this is what we're driving. And, you know, whether I was right or wrong, or that wasn't the point. It was that he was making it really clear. If you send this is important, well, then this should be here in these forms for these players to consume it. And like, it just constantly kept you on your toes.
Okay, very good. I actually think it might have been him, but the saying good people make good players, do you agree with this? Is this something, is it a cliche? What do you make of it?
I don't know. I would love to say that, you know, there's a really close, you know, that the both of them are intertwined, and that the relationship between being a good person and a good athlete, you know, that there's that symbiosis and that they're equally invested in both. Like one of the nicest players I've ever met in my life, one of the most generous and kind, is Josh van der Fleer, who is also, you know, when I think about all the things that we've talked about, of being what a great professional is and what a great person is, then there's the perfect example. And you've had Johnny Cooper on this as well. He's one of the most selfless people, one of the most giving people, and one of the most supporting of me, particularly as our relationship developed over the years. But there are people who are brutally selfish, who are exceptional sports people. And I think if you were to ask the question, as a team sport, do good people, if you've got good people in the environment and they are selfless and they are driving good behaviors and it is about the collective, I think that's what's needed to sustain success. But people on an individual basis can still get to the top and compete at the highest level for themselves.
Yeah, and that's the argument that I've kind of mentioned a few times in the podcast. It's like, you have to be so selfish in your own preparation and your own training and to push yourself to be your best. But then when you're a part of a team, when you step into the doors, that has to go out the window. It has to be about the group. It has to be about the collective. And sometimes it's difficult for athletes because you're going from such a selfish mindset of me, me, me to the team. And that can sometimes be a really difficult concept to grasp.
Well, what I would say about that is that it depends on what you want your legacy to be. So, you know, if you want to pass on what you've learned and you want it to be for the better of the group, then you can do that. But you need to have that mindset. But, you know, so it is a fine balance. And I have seen people do it incredibly well. But I also think that you need very strong management that has equal standards for all. And unless that's happening, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to manage when people are self-driven.
The GEA kind of have a great motto with, you know, everyone has a chance at Intercounty. It's all, you know, inclusive. But can anyone be an elite athlete? Does it take a certain characteristic or not characteristic, but traits? What do you think?
I think anybody can be an elite athlete. Like I see people go on after playing GAA at junior level or intermediate level and do extraordinary things in other sports. I think we have an idea in our head because of society and what we see in media and social media of what it means. But the reality of it is just, I try and communicate this around performance. So you're talking about an attitude towards how you perform day to day. You know, I see people run businesses, CEOs and directors of companies, and they're operating at the highest level, making really strategic decisions, but they don't invest the same way in their wellness, or they don't invest in their health, and they don't see that in order to sustain those decisions and sustain their bodies mentally and physically managing that stress, that if they haven't built up that resilience, they won't maintain it. So it's a broader, more holistic set of behaviors. And if you have that mindset towards it, anybody can be a high performer. Anybody can be an elite athlete.
I recently had retired Irish Sevens rugby player Foster Horan on, and I asked him to kind of dispel any myths about kind of elite level sport. And one thing he picked up on was interesting was drinking bans. Something we see a lot in kind of the amateur setup of GAA club, where they come in, the senior manager comes in and says, lad, you know, we're on a drinking ban till at least March because we've pre-season. From a performance standpoint, is it, you know, drinking bans, are they effective? What is your take on it?
Oh, look, I've done skits to this. Like, drinking bans don't work. There's absolutely no question or doubt about it. The only thing that I would say is, like, it's the players and the players, like the leaders within a group, that have to set these standards and what that looks like. And that's about the broader culture. And if you will find that if people are drinking alcohol, and if they're over consuming or they're abusing alcohol, then there's going to be other aspects of the preparation that they're compromising on as well. You know, whether that be sleep, or that be nutrition, whether that be the work that they need to do in training, whether that be their rehab or prehab, whatever it might be, you'll find that that's been compromised. So it's very easy. And when you pick one or two things and you go really hard at it, that's about a statement, but it's very narrow-minded. So just to add that, like, there's absolutely no question that alcohol is extremely detrimental when consumed excessively. Like, I mean, it's scary, because I come from a home, we love a glass of wine with dinner. You know, I have, as time has gone on, been made so much more aware of the implications of sustained overconsumption of alcohol. And we do need to nurture a more positive relationship, and that starts with not having drinking bans and creating safe environments within groups. Like, one of the things about Ballyboden that I think is just fantastic is, like, they'll meet for a couple of pints after a championship game, and it's about them being together. I haven't seen anybody being drunk. You know, so that's what I'm talking about. That's when it's not being abused, and it's being used for the right reasons, and that there's a fun and morale element to it, and that's where it stopped. And the other thing I'd add is that there's no peer pressure. I see 5 and 6 lads not drinking on those nights out, and there's not a word said.
I want to ask you, actually, particularly about Ballyboden. You said, I think it was again the Moving 101 podcast, that was a great interview, by the way, you said winning a Club All-Ireland wasn't satisfying. Can you explain that statement? Because, kind of, you know, we dream of, you know, growing up playing at Croke Park, winning All-Ireland medals, but to kind of hear that from somebody that has done it, what was your take and perspective on it for anyone listening that might have these dreams and aspirations, and you kind of build it up in your head to be this pinnacle of success, and for you it wasn't?
I think if you had asked some of the other players, it very well might have been. I think that was probably a little bit too personal to me. If I'm telling the whole truth about it, so I suppose just to give you a very, 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 very quick insight to my mindset. When I say I'm all in on something, when I'm committed to something, I mean every fiber of what I do, every cell points to that direction when I'm focused on it. I mean, I am totally, totally consumed by it. And my vision for, you talked about vision for success. My vision for success is measured in contribution. It's measured on impact and it's measured in value. And what tended to happen, particularly throughout that period of time, was I was an older member of the squad and I gave all that I possibly could, you know, physically, mentally, and to the group. But I wanted my impact to be measured on what I was contributing on the field. And I felt like there was a lot of references to my leadership and there was a lot of references to the kind of impact that I was having on the broader culture. And that wasn't why I was putting my boots on. So when that was over, I would have looked back and felt that there was other games and there was other things that I was a part of that I made much bigger contributions to that felt much more gratifying and fulfilling. The thing as well, I suppose, was that was a huge pinnacle. It was a huge moment. And like the come down, like I've never said this before, but my mother thought I wouldn't say I slipped into depression. I don't think I've suffered from depression, but the low off the back of the All-Ireland was just, I can't describe how low it was.
Okay. Was that because of the impact you wanted to have and you didn't necessarily have that?
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it, but also the fact that it was the guts of 2 years of work and now it was over. And again, I've never said this before, but you know, while I was incredibly proud of and wouldn't have, you know, of my associations at Dublin and Leinster, I had to go back into those environments and I was ashamed of not having the impact. Like that day, that was not how I had envisaged my day, you know, that was not how I envisaged what North Ireland should feel like. And I was ashamed of my lack of contribution and that stayed with me. And there's, even as I'm saying it, you know, there's still elements of it, because here's the thing. I know I would have had huge belief about what my impact could be. And I knew that that wasn't a fair reflection of it. And that's really hard to live with.
No, it definitely is. And it's kind of, again, back to that elite performance environment where it's difficult. Like, it's not only physically challenging, but mentally. What is it? I get the sense from talking to you that it's actually more of a mental challenge being involved at such an elite level, while there is such physical challenges and such physical training, but the mental aspect might be the tougher element.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the way that people have to deal with injury, they have to deal with non-selection, being left out of squads, being out of form. And like, you need to be so resilient to manage all that and figure your way through it. And I would have done my best to support athletes going through that and always making them feel like there's a plan that can be done to help you get through this, and just that they would have felt supported. But you know, when it comes down to it, when it boils down to it, in life, we have to do this stuff ourselves. And sometimes that's really hard. We have to find it from within, you know, that's it.
Great point. I was telling you before we hit record what I'm doing next week, but if I could hand you the key to any, it might, maybe not sport, but any setup in the world to go in and be a fly on the wall for a week, what would it be and why? Who would it be and why?
I It's a really good question. And I'm not sure I know the answer to that, because as I was saying to you, when I was at that training last week with Northwestern, and I was in their environment and I saw them train and I saw the energy between them, the openness, the curiosity, the music, the vibrancy, like I could feel something, stir inside me that would have loved to experience this as an athlete myself, and where it could have brought me. So you don't know where that is. That's what I'm saying. But I am fascinated by the likes of the Navy SEALs, and the kind of what they have to endure, and how that space has evolved, and what are the limits of human performance, and what can be done to prepare people for the greatest feats of performance. And when I would have heard stories from Navy SEALs or people who have operated in those arenas and in those real life situations, just how those people make decisions under pressure, which are life and death, and usually just the responsibility associated with that compared to kicking a ball over the bar, so that intrigues me.
Brilliant. I'm very conscious of time because I feel like we could keep talking for hours here. I'm going to move on to the sideline seven. It's the same seven questions at the end of every episode. Question one, Daniel, what is your favorite quote?
I'll paraphrase. There's a David Katz. He is the former president of lifestyle medicine in the States. He talks about knowledge versus practice, and it's not what we know, it's what we do with what we know. And that phrase and that quote has driven me to read more, to talk more, to reflect more on my practice, to help people apply themselves more and use the information that they have and understand that the tools are within themselves for success.
Okay, interesting. Is there any particular book that's kind of stood out to you then when you're searching along that, kind of going, taking that quote as your kind of benchmark? Is there any particular book you found beneficial towards that?
Many, but not directly correlated to David Katz. It's more the Matthew Syed books, the Black Box Thinking, the Rebel Ideas. I'm sure, you've read them yourselves, but it's the James Clear and Charles Duhigg, The Power of Habit. It's these books that get us thinking an awful lot more about what drives our subconscious, what influences our decisions on an emotional level, on a physiological level, rather than just the information that's presented to us. Like, I can't tell you how many questions I get every day about whether it's one banana or three bananas, or is milk good, or how many eggs. Like, we continue to miss the point when it comes to our health.
Okay, interesting. Question two, best sporting event you've been to, and you can pick one as a fan and one that you were involved in any capacity.
Any of the All-Ireland finals and the Champions Cup final in Bilbao was truly extraordinary in the way that finished. The All-Ireland final between Dublin and Mayo as well in 2018, another, just extraordinary experiences.
Mm-hmm. Question three, what's been the biggest setback or challenge so far in your career, and how did you react to it?
Because I told you about it, I'm going to tell you that that experience around the All-Ireland final was a big, big setback. And how did I respond to it? Not well for a long period of time. And but good things came out of it. I moved home and I played football at home, and I found something really new. It was an opportunity to try things and to build new and renew relationships. So that was really positive.
Brilliant. Question four, kind of on the flip side then, what's been your biggest achievement on or off the pitch?
My biggest achievement has been a theme that's run throughout our conversations. My biggest achievement has been figuring out how to help people find their strengths and realize that they can achieve things, like helping people to really unlock their potential, you know, and that's by asking the right questions.
Okay, very good. Looking back,
learning to ask the right question.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Looking back, what advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
That who you are is good enough, and that you'll figure it out.
Okay, very good. Who would be your dream dinner guest and why? You can open up the table to a few people if you want.
I have dinner with some of my friends every year, and it's around Christmas, and we joke about Roy Keane coming to dinner because we've all been Roy Keane fans, and that would be make it more interesting. But I can tell you that the dinners around Christmas and the dinners that we have as friends, we're pretty good with the groups that we have.
Roy Keane has been referenced I don't know how many times at this point during that question. But for you, Daniel, what are you cooking for that sort of meal? Are you getting a takeaway? What's your go-to?
I've made homemade lasagna, and even I've had Paul Mannion and Paddy Andrews and some of those lads over a few times to the house, and I've made vegetarian lasagna and regular lasagna with fresh pasta sheets, and it's really good. It's a great sharing dish.
Okay, very good. Final question before I let you go. You've been so generous with your time. If your life was a book, what chapter would this be called?
Empower.
Empower. Love it. I know you have your own two books coming out. You've plenty of stuff on social media. Where is the best place for any of the listeners to find you if they want to reach out or ask you a question?
Yeah, thank you very much. I actually have a big book launch for my new book on the 28th of October at home in Sligo. So if anybody who's listened to this in the west of Ireland wants to come and join and get their book signed, that would be great. At Davy Nutrition, and my first name is Daniel again, at Davy Nutrition on social media and davynutrition.com on my website.
Brilliant. Daniel, thanks a million for coming on, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you for your time and having me on. Appreciate it.
A big thank you to Daniel for joining me on the podcast today. I thoroughly enjoyed our chat and I hope you got something from it. I just want to wish him the best of luck with his brand new book launch in the next couple of weeks, and I'll be sure to leave a link in the description box below. If you are enjoying the podcast, please do leave a rating and a review over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as it does help the show grow. A massive thank you for all your support to date, and I'll catch you in the next one.